Believe it or not, this is due to smoke from the U.S. wildfires, which is being transported across the country via the jet stream. New York City air quality was among the worst in the world as cities across the eastern U.S. were shrouded in smoke from wildfires ranging several thousand miles away on the country's west coast. The smoke will affect the air quality today, making it unhealthy. A code orange air quality alert is in effect. Smoke from more than 80 major wildfires burning in the west has caused hazy skies and plunging air quality in American and Canadian cities, including Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, Toronto, and New York. Currently in Washington, it's rainy and 84 degrees. In New York, it's stormy and 73. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington and WBAI New York.
The time now is 1 minute past 2 p.m. Stay tuned for the next program coming up. As a programming note, the minefield and Live on the Fly will be back on the air at its regular time, 2 and 2:30 p.m. respectively. In the meantime, take a listen to this upcoming program that's about to air.
Listening to a special Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we, the people, for another world is possible. And we are the ones to make it so. And through the lens of critical race theory, which essentially acknowledges that systemic racism is interwoven in the very fabric of America. On WBAI 99.5 FM's Equal Rights and Justice, we challenge any premise that allows racism and discrimination to flourish. And that's the very reason that white supremacist demagogues challenge critical race theory, which is really a holistic version of American history that doesn't erase the accomplishments of black people or skirt around the fact that racism is real and that American exceptionalism in its inception is myth. America's origin was premised on settler colonialism, thus the theft of Indian land, and then by using every means to thwart the indigenous people's resistance. And then it would steal the labor of and seek to control the very soul of people of African ancestry as it rooted the system of plantation capitalism. In order for us to move towards the promise of democracy and make things better for our future generations. We must be willing to address those issues that have allowed systemic racism, discrimination, and the ideology of white superiority and benefit of whiteness, of white supremacy to continue. And so we educate and agitate and organize this day against Jim Crow then and now. Jim Crow laws are a dirty episode in American politics that bears remembering for the fact that their repetition will be inevitable otherwise. Initially conceived in the South in 1876 by white Southern Democratic-dominated state legislatures to remove political and economic gains made by black people during the Reconstruction period, we are once again witnessing the embrace of laws for African Americans that disenfranchise them economically, politically, and socially. Now, Jim Crow, then and now.
Conflict over black emancipation is as old as the nation. In 1861, the South left the Union rather than remain part of a country that restricted the expansion of slavery. At first, Abraham Lincoln saw the struggle as simply a war to save the nation. But in time, he would recast the Civil War as a war to end slavery. On January 1st, 1863, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing all slaves in the Confederate States. 6 months after the South surrendered, Congress ratified the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. The federal government had made a promise to the former slaves, these newly freed men and women who knew what they wanted, education and the right to vote, equal rights in the courts, and mostly land.
What is it that your people need now that you're free? Our people need land, and they need tools to work the land. So there we began to see the priority to own our own land.
Every colored man will be a slave and feel himself a slave until he can raise his own bale of cotton and put his own mark upon it and says, "This is mine." Without independence and self-employment, freedom would be meaningless. Peter Hall.
On Edisto Island off the coast of South Carolina, thousands of newly freed blacks were making that dream come true. On land abandoned by their former masters and given to them by the Union Army, they had built schools and churches, established family and community life. But they had heard rumors that their future was at risk. Lincoln had been assassinated, and a Southerner, Andrew Johnson, was president. Johnson fought to save the Union, but not to free slaves. "This is a country for white men," he said. "And as long as I'm president, it will be a government for white men."
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
On October 19th, 1865, a boat carrying a deeply troubled Union general, Oliver O. Howard, slowly made its way toward Edisto. Howard was known as the Christian General, a deeply religious man who hated slavery. He was in charge of the new Freedmen's Bureau established by Congress that year to protect the confiscated lands given to the former slaves. Howard was revered second only to Lincoln by free blacks.
They got the message from the Freedmen's Bureau that the general was coming back, General Oliver O. Howard, who they were expecting to hear nothing but good news from him because he was the man who had told them about how this land now was transferred to them and that they owned it and they didn't have to worry about master no more and everything. he asked them to gather together at the church on Edisto. So over 2,000 people came from all amongst the oak trees and all back off in the woods and from their shacks and their dirt roads to meet there at the church to hear this new discussion about their land.
I have been sent by the president to tell you that your old masters have been pardoned and their plantations are to be given back to them, and that they would hire blacks to work for them. Lay aside your bitter feelings and be reconciled to them. General Oliver O. Howard.
So people were enraged and people started hollering out, no, no, ain't no way. No, no, that ain't what you tell us before. No, sir, no, sir.
General Howard, why do you take away our lands? You take them from us who are true, always true to the government. You give them to our all-time enemies. The man who gave me 39 lashes and who stripped and flogged my mother and sister. Who keeps land from me well knowing I would not have anything to do with him if I had land of my own. That man I cannot well forgive. A freedman.
Some went into nobody know the trouble we see. Sometimes some went into motherless child and all those things rippled off the sea.
Like a motherless child, a long way from home.
1 year later, in 1866, Congress, recognizing continued Southern resistance to black emancipation, passed the 14th and 15th Amendments, guaranteeing blacks the right to vote and due process of law. The time of Reconstruction had begun. But many whites did not plan on fulfilling the intentions of the new laws. Mississippi passed a black code, giving courts the right to apprentice former slaves, with preference to their former owners.
The Negro is free whether we like it or not. For the purity and progress of both races, they must accept their place in the lower order of things. That place is the cotton fields of the South. Such is the rule of the plantation and the law of God. Governor Benjamin Humphreys.
But blacks did not see themselves trapped in the cotton fields. They used their vote to elect black representatives, sat on juries, and sent their children to school.
What had alarmed the white South during Reconstruction was not evidence of black failure, but evidence of black success, evidence of black assertion, evidence of black independence, evidence of black advancement, and evidence that black men were learning the uses of political power.
If intimidation would not keep blacks in their place, then violence might. In the same year that Reconstruction began, Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general, founded the Ku Klux Klan. The image of the Klan in white hoods killing blacks by the light of burning crosses would forever be etched in the American mind.
The way white supremacists made sure that ex-slaves would fall back into place or nearly back into place was terror. Beating people up, burning down their houses, shooting them, just the usual physical mayhem of personal violence.
Although they were beaten into submission and retreat, 1869 offered a glimmer of hope with the election of Civil War hero Ulysses S. Grant to the presidency. And Grant delivered. He sent federal troops to the South to counter groups like the Klan. But for the black community, even federal intervention was not enough.
The question of, should we stay at home in the South? Should we stay at home in the United States? Should we move somewhere else, to the North? Should we move to the West? Or should we leave the United States entirely?
trapped and helpless and in need of answers, some turned to an unlikely source, an old man who had been born in slavery.
We needed land for our children. That caused my heart to grieve in sorrow. Pity for my race caused me to work for them. Confidence has perished and faded away. We are going to leave the South. Pap Singleton.
In 1874, Pap Singleton, a former slave, would lead a group of 300 blacks to Kansas. John Brown struck his first blow against slavery there. God must be in Kansas, and black people wanted to go where God was. No one spoke this call stronger than Sojourner Truth.
I have prayed so long that my people would go to Kansas and that God would make straight the way before them. This colored people is going to be a people. Do you think God has them robbed and scourged all the days of their life for nothing?
Many of the people saw their promised land. They saw their Jordan River being those places that they had to cross over into, where freedom would be away from those who had basically had their feet on their necks all this time, just like the Pharaoh had done in the Bible. So many of them followed their leaders so that they could have their life to themselves, however they wanted that to be built.
They also believed in the God of Daniel, who was an avenging God. This is the God of the apocalypse, the God of the second coming, the God of the decision of who was going to go to heaven and who was going to go to hell.
But as much as Kansas loomed as a promised land for many blacks, getting there could become a journey through hell. Many would perish from starvation and exposure. One group fell victim to yellow fever. And there was always the fear of murderous whites.
I saw colored men and women cast themselves to the ground in despair. Heard them groan and shout their lamentations. What is to become of these wretched people, God only knows. Here were nearly 500,000, scattered along the banks of the mighty Mississippi, without shelter, without food, with no hope of escaping from their present surrounding, and hardly a chance of returning from whence they came. Riverboat Captain.
For those who survived to make it to Kansas, they found a land of hard winters, torrential rains, and violent tornadoes. But through spiritual and emotional conviction, they sustained themselves. And within a few years, over 20 towns would be built. But not all blacks thought the answer was to leave the South. Frederick Douglass, a former slave who had become the leading black voice for abolition, opposed any mass exodus.
The country will be told of the hundreds who go to Kansas, but not of the thousands who stay in Mississippi. They will be told of the destitute who require material aid, but not of the multitude who are bravely sustaining themselves where they are. If the people of this country cannot be protected in every state of the Union, the sovereignty of the nation is an empty one, and the power in individual states is greater than the power of the United States. Frederick Douglass.
In 1877, Republican President Rutherford B. Hayes, who had won the election by making a deal for electoral votes from Southern Democrats, pulled federal troops from the South. The party of Lincoln had betrayed the former slaves. Reconstruction was over. Whites began to reassert their power over blacks, politically, legally, and economically. And nowhere was this change more crushing than for those blacks who were farmers, most of whom were sharecroppers.
Owners controlled their little worlds. So there was no police power, there was no federal power, there was no state power that actually made a difference on the ground. So you had relations of dependency built around obedience and submission. That was the ideology of the culture of slavery, obedience and submission.
Here was the black man, having very limited education, not knowing how to figure and to read, with the books being kept by the white man who is giving him his supplies to start a crop, and likewise on the land. When the black man ended up at the end of the year and brought his crop in, the white man immediately arranged to outfigure him.
The man would take your cotton, and then the man at the store, you had credit, he run the books up on you, so you didn't have nothing. You work a whole year and hand pick 40 bales of cotton and come out with nothing.
Frustrated by the unfulfilled promise of emancipation, blacks turned to the next generation, to their children. They believed education would be the key to overcome white dominance.
Then and now, that's what you've been listening to, which offers the first comprehensive look at race relations in America between the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. It is a definitive four-part series that documents a brutal and oppressive era rooted in the growing refusal of many Southern states to grant slaves freed in the Civil War equal rights with whites, a life of crushing limitation for Southern blacks defined by legal segregation known as Jim Crow, after a minstrel routine in which whites painted their faces black. That shaped the social, political, and legal history of the period. In 1954, when the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education, the Jim Crow laws and way of life began to fall. But this is the struggle during the Jim Crow era, and Jim Crow then and now. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, looking at the way Jim Crow has restored and gained supremacy in the criminal justice system. We're looking at the totality of laws that are being passed today, the enormity of the voter suppression to begin to give the idea of the restoration again and furthering of Jim Crow laws, of white backlash to the gains of blacks, just as it was during the Reconstruction period. The voter suppression laws in Georgia and other Republican states smack of Jim Crow rearing its ugly head once again. It is 160 years since the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments abolished slavery, and Jim Crow is still with us.
the laws in Republican state legislatures across the country are one of the greatest threats we have to democracy in America. And these laws could strain every available method of voting for tens of millions of Americans, the most sweeping contradiction of ballot access in the United States since the end of Reconstruction. If one political party believes that when you lose an election, the answer isn't to win more votes, but rather to try and prevent the other side from voting, we have an existential threat to democracy on our hands. If we don't stop these vicious and often racist actions, autocracy will be on the way. That is why the country so badly needed S1 or the For the People Act, which, of course, critics warn will strip power from the states and federalize U.S. elections. A bill that would combat all of these voter suppression efforts. A bill that would make it easier, not harder, to vote by automatically registering American voters when they get a driver's license, by guaranteeing at least 15 continuous days of early voting, a bill that would limit dark money and corruption in our politics and much more. Well, we've been down this road before. Opponents of voting rights throughout history have always said, leave it to the states. Just leave it to the states to discriminate against African Americans, Latinx people, Native Americans, younger Americans in college. The crowning achievement of the American Civil Rights Movement was a federal election law. Say what? Well, you've been listening to part of a series that is essential educational viewing. It is disconcerting, illuminating, and riveting. It highlights a history of betrayed promises and civil disobedience, of racial terror and aspiration of faith and nihilism. Jim Crow then and now. And I want to make these tools available to you to use at this point with the restoration, the rising up, the codification of new Jim Crow laws. So we're looking at the history and evolution of Jim Crow then and now, which highlights the richness and diversity of African American reactions to segregations, showing how even in the worst depths of racism, the struggle for freedom persists. I'm asking you to go to your phone now and to call 212-209-2950. It's almost lyrical, that number, 212-209-2950, to pledge to support WBAI. That does what? It upholds critical race theory. Critical race theory? It upholds the truth and truth-telling and changing the narrative to write African American history into the lexicon of learning. Because after all, education is one of the great equalizers. Not surprising that there are those who would try to stamp it out, who are repelled by critical race theory. This four-series set, actually, I'm going to make it five because I'm doing an add-on. We're dealing with Jim Crow then and now, a five-part series. I'll tell you more about the fifth disc, but it is hours of listening. It is the history of backlash and state codification of repression against African Americans, against people of African ancestry post the Reconstruction period, and is renewed today because any gains that are made, there is the sufferance of a white rage and a white backlash for people who cannot and will not cast off their white supremacy, regardless of their educational veil that they may use to be repelled by critical race theory. You know, in recent weeks, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Iowa, Idaho, and Texas have all passed legislation that places significant restrictions on what you can learn in public school classrooms and in some cases public universities as well. You know, the Tennessee House Bill SB 0623, for example, bans any teaching, now get this, any teaching that could lead an individual to feel discomfort, a guilt, anguish, or another form of psychological distress solely because of the individual's race or sex. In addition to this vague prescription, it restricts teaching that leads to division between or resentment of a race, sex, religion, creed, nonviolent political affiliation, social class, or class of people. Well, Texas House Bill also 3979. It goes even further, right? It forbids teaching that slavery. It forbids teaching that slavery and racism are anything other than deviations from, betrayals of, or failures to live up to the authentic founding principles of the United States. It also bars any classroom reform requiring an understanding of the 1619 Project that the New York Times Magazine special issue devoted to a reframing of the nation's founding, and hence prohibits assigning any part of it as required reading. This is what we're up against. But at WBAI, we uphold, we understand the necessity for critical race theory. We offer thought-provoking documentaries which will inspire viewers to re-examine our understanding of democracy as well as our thoughts about racism and social injustices. And this four-part series, five-part because we're going to give you an add-on, Jim Crow Then and Now, this series is all America should see, because without comprehending its content, we have no way of fully understanding who we were and by extension, who we are. I'm asking you to support critical race theory, to support yourself, to work as hard as you can to root out the Achilles heel of the promise of American democracy, and that is white supremacy, institutional racism. And you can do it by having these teaching tools. Form study groups on it. Do what? Educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people who have been sold a myth of American exceptionalism when we have a country that was founded on settler colonialism, which has bred class collaborationists with what? With what? With segregationists, with virulent racists, indeed with the fascist white nationalists and white supremacists who stormed the Capitol, who created a situation for insurrection on January 6th. Dear sisters and brothers, now is our time. Now is the time to support WBAI, because we understand how powerful what we say here and the teaching of critical race theory. And this series, Jim Crow, Then and Now, a powerful and dramatic documentary on black life under Jim Crow, which captures its horrors, its brutality and power in graphic detail while maintaining a central focus on how African Americans both endured, resisted, and challenged the system and do today. Call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Ask for Jim Crow Then and Now. It is a four-part series. The fifth part takes us through one of the critical issue, and it does so with the study of Minnesota, Minneapolis, and it looks at restrictive covenants as they originated and redlining, because all of that is part of Jim Crow. And if you want to understand more about what happened to George Floyd, how the policing patterns evolved and control of communities, you have to understand the restrictive covenants. You have to understand bank redlining and where people are allowed to live, etc., and in effect ghettoize, etc., so that they can be controlled by the policing apparatus. And that had everything to do with constructing a racial justice analysis and rectification for the brutality and the murder of the policing apparatus that took the life of George Floyd. It's a much more comprehensive picture to understand how and why police do what they do. And I maintain that when you get Jim Crow then and now with the add-on, with the five disc set, you will be enlivened, enriched, you will be educated, and you will be holding what we must high, which is education, critical race theory. And anyone who repudiates that is most definitively riddled with white supremacy and a sense of white superiority. We need to feel uncomfortable about the origins and behavior of this country. We need to work against the special benefit and privilege that whiteness permits in order to do what? To reach egalitarianism, to reach equal rights and justice for those who have been oppressed and deprived of it. I ask you now to call 212-209-2950. To support WBAI, it's a $125 pledge for this four-series set and the fifth disc add-on. Jim Crow, then and now. Jim Crow, then and now. I'm asking you to support BAI. Surely you understand that there are those who continue to try to corporatize us and how vulnerable we are. How vulnerable we are. And our Achilles heel is about how many supporters we have. How many of you out there are willing to go online and be on the line to support the only network that speaks truth to power, that is willing to see the class struggle through the lens of racial oppression and racial justice. There is no other entity, no other media platform in the country that consistently, and at BAI for over 61 years, has spoken on these issues. And it doesn't just do so from an armchair intellectual perspective. It does so to do what? To educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for equal rights and justice and the realization of the promise of democracy. Support BAI like you never have before. You must. This is the time. And support yourself by getting this extraordinary, extraordinary Jim Crow then and now, this excellent series that serves as a really top-notch prequel to Eyes on the Prize, for example. I highly recommend it. $125, Jim Crow then and now. And so we return now. Jim Crow then and now. Oh, did I not give you the number? 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I get so excited when I listen to this material. I learn so much. It fortifies some of the information that I had, but constantly brings me new information and excites and stimulates me to do what? To be part of the process of building into the narrative of America, the African-American betrayal experience, the experience and betrayal of oppressed people. To what end? For equal rights and justice. So I want you to get on that horn now, 212-209-2950. Ask for Jim Crow then and now to support the incomparably important WBAI. And to do what else? Well, for your contribution, your support to the station, because you make it happen. You're what enables us not to be corporatized. That's what it's about. It's your station. Whose station? Your station. And if you want it to be, and if you are someone who struggles against white supremacy and believes that we need every tool and device and mechanism to do so, that it is indeed a metastasized cancer that has to be taken out of the body politic, root and branch, grab from that poisonous soil of plantation capitalism that is the system of this country. Root it out, pull it out. And these films are some of the greatest educational tools that you can have. And at a time when people are trying to take that away from us. 212-209-2950. Okay, so I'm being told here, why don't you let people listen? Why don't you let people listen? Okay, I will curb my enthusiasm, my love for and belief in this station, my belief in you, the listener, to support it so that we can go back and hear some more of this phenomenal, phenomenal Jim Crow then and now, this absolutely magnificent package of educational films just for you.
1898, the United States Supreme Court, having already allowed Southern states the right to segregate blacks, now approved denying them the vote. In the same year, most of the blacks living in the South worked the white man's land, averaging less than a dollar a day. In 1898, 101 black men were lynched in the South. But one southern city, nestled comfortably along the Cape Fear River of North Carolina, seems to have escaped the worst excesses of the Jim Crow years. Wilmington seemed to be a racially moderate city, a condition brought about by economic prosperity and a strong black and white middle class.
The best feeling among the races prevailed in Wilmington. The Negro and his white brother walked their beats on the police force. White and black committeemen sat down together in the same council. White and black teachers taught in the same school. David Fulton.
It was a booming place for African Americans. They simply felt as if they were making a contribution to society 33 years after they were freed through Emancipation Proclamation.
It was a prospering African-American community in the largest city of the state. They had attained some success in the middle classes. There was a growing mercantile class.
What happened was a number of blacks were able to transfer skills that they learned in slavery to private enterprise. On the plantation, they were blacksmiths, they were carpenters, they were teamsters. They had all these different skills that they learned in slavery, which they weren't being compensated for. But now they were able to take those skills and transfer them into business, and that's what happened.
That first generation out of slavery sort of bought the dream. They thought that they would get education, they would rise, they would be successful. And that kind of performance would prove their manhood and womanhood.
One successful Wilmington African American was Alex Manley, publisher of the Wilmington Daily Record, the only black daily newspaper in North Carolina.
He says his relationship with whites is good, and there's every reason to believe that. White merchants advertise extensively in the Daily Record. But he clearly sees the future place of black people as being full equality. There's no question about that. And he's constantly encouraging them to become equals economically, politically, socially, culturally.
There were many whites who were poverty-stricken, but there were many blacks who had very good-paying jobs. Of course, they had their carriages and their nice dress, and they would shop, and they felt as if they had come a long way. And they were beginning to feel themselves in a prideful sort of way, and I think to a degree in an arrogant sort of way. So there we had much tension created. How dare you think that you are so much better than I am?
It's partly economic competition, but it's also a grave concern that black people are beginning to feel the equals to white people.
White people became quite alarmed because if they were going to subjugate black people, they had to prove that no black person was capable of the things that these people were doing.
Blacks had attained a good deal of power in Wilmington in 1898. They were the majority of the population and of the voting population.
Many of the blacks at that time held elected positions and very prominent municipal positions. They were appointed by the Republicans. Most of the Republicans at that time were black.
Justices of the peace, aldermen, magistrates, firemen, public health workers, even though these might not appear to be very high prestige positions, at least they were examples to the black community and particularly to the youth of what black people could be.
Whites were fearful that the African Americans would begin to control the city of Wilmington since they were in the majority.
We have to look at two very basic issues. You have to look at politics and you have to look at economics. And whoever controls those two are in power. And it was all about power, about political power and economic power.
In the statewide and local elections of 1898, the Democratic Party, the party of white supremacy, was determined to end black political power in North Carolina.
It will be the meanest, vilest, dirtiest campaign since 1876.
They argue that only the Democrats can save North Carolina from what they call Negro rule.
Fernifold Simmons, who would go on to be a United States Senator, Charles Aycock, who would go on to be governor of North Carolina, and Josephus Daniels, who was editor of the Raleigh News and Observer, the three of them got together in a hotel and hatched a campaign that would talk about white women being endangered by black men holding office.
The white press portrayed blacks as monsters, representing them as an incubus, a mythical figure that raped women while they slept.
White women appeared in parades, on floats, in white dresses, holding up signs saying, "Protect us."
Deliberately fueling racial fires, a white newspaper published an inflammatory speech given by a leading Georgia feminist, Rebecca Felton.
"If it requires lynching to protect woman's dearest possession from ravening, drunken human beasts, then I say lynch 1,000 Negroes a week, if it is necessary."
Manley's blood boils and he dashes off his own editorial that conservative black people in Wilmington considered to be a truth unwisely said.
"Our experience with poor white women in the country teaches us that the women of that race are not any more particular in the manner of clandestine meetings with colored men than white men with colored women. You leave your goods out of doors and then complain because they are taken away. Alex Manley."
The crowning thing that hit the white psychic nerve center was the very last sentence of the editorial, where he says, "If white men continue to initiate sex with black women, sooner or later, white women are going to start to do the very same thing with black men." And that was not the political thing to say. That just drove white men absolutely crazy.
A former Confederate officer, Alfred Waddell, called for violence.
We are resolved to change the conditions under which we live if we have to choke the Cape Fear River with carcasses.
White men appeared in rallies all over the state wearing red shirts, which was sort of a pre-fascist kind of outfit that they had borrowed from South Carolina.
White employers are threatening to fire black employees who register to vote. So there's massive economic intimidation going on.
An organization of black women urged black men to vote or risk disgrace.
Every Negro who refuses to register this next Tuesday in order that he may vote, we shall make it our business to deal with him in a way that shall not be pleasant. He shall be branded as a white-livered coward who would sell his liberty.
Blacks meant to win by legal means. Whites, by any means.
We shall win tomorrow if we have to do it with guns. If we have not the votes to carry the election, we must carry it by force. If you find a Negro voting, tell him to leave the poll. If he refuses, kill him. Alfred Waddell.
Despite all the intimidation, many, many black voters were turning out and were voting. So the word goes out from Democratic headquarters that if we can intimidate the black votes and get a majority that way, we will simply stuff the ballot boxes. And that's exactly what they do.
Every black candidate in North Carolina was defeated. But in Wilmington, the political victory did not satisfy white anger. A mob set Manley's newspaper on fire, and every black official was driven out of office.
They could not wait until it was time for the change of office to take place.
They decided to take control of everything.
It was basically a coup. They just took the offices away from the duly elected office holders.
So there are no longer any black officials in Wilmington city government.
The coup was followed by a massacre.
Firing began, and it seemed like a mighty battle in wartime. They went on firing, it seemed, at every living Negro, poured volleys into fleeing men like sportsmen firing at rabbits in an open field. The shrieks and screams of children, of mothers and wives, caused the blood of the most inhuman person to creep. Men lay on the street dead and dying, while members of their race walked by, unable to do them any good. Reverend Alan Kirk.
They went after business owners. They went after voters. They went after doctors and black lawyers. Those are the people they ran out of town because those are the people they saw as getting out of their place and therefore encouraging other black people to get out of their places.
Despite the odds against them, some blacks fought back. Others protested to the federal government.
Blacks from all over the United States wrote letters to the President of the United States begging him to intervene and to stop the violence and the killing in Wilmington.
President William McKinley remained silent.
I think it showed that the national government had lost its commitment to protecting the civil and political rights of blacks, especially in the South.
Charles Francis Bork, a northern reporter, witnessed blacks fleeing from the city.
In the woods and swamps, hundreds of innocent, terrified men and women wander about, fearful of the vengeance of whites, fearful of death. Without money or food, insufficiently clothed, they fled from civilization and sought refuge in the wilderness. In the night, I hear children crying. And the voice crooning a mournful song.
Others did not escape. Like 12-year-old Cy Williams, sentenced to 20 years on a convict lease gang for taking a horse he was too small to ride. 8-year-old Will Evans, who received 2 years for stealing change off a store counter. And Mary Gay, sentenced to 30 days for taking a hat
she was 6 years old.
By the turn of the century, tens of thousands of Americans, one quarter of whom were children, had been condemned to hard labor in convict lease camps.
Convict leasing was slavery's replacement. It has been described as worse than slavery, and in every respect it really was. What typically would happen is that some landowner, somebody who needed workers for the mines, someone who was going to build a railroad, would come into a community and say, I need, you know, 600 men. And these companies would pay the states a certain amount of money for this labor. And it was a very profitable system for economic development in the Deep South.
To supply the demand for convict labor, sheriffs arrested blacks for misdemeanors and vagrancy. Judges sentenced them to far harsher terms than whites charged with the same crime. For petty theft, a white man might receive 90 days in jail. A black man, 2 years on a convict lease gang.
To get the quota, law enforcement would not think twice about finding any able-bodied person, including 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old kids.
They cleared snake and alligator swamps, dug coal and gas-filled mines, built railroads and tapped turpentine trees in 100-degree-plus heat. Men worked 14 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, in conditions that one convict described as nine kinds of hell. Sometimes housed in rolling iron cages, like those used for circus animals, fed the worst of food, denied medical treatment, men died from malaria, scurvy, frostbite, sunstroke, dysentery, snakebite, and shackle poisoning. They were blown to bits in tunnel explosions, buried in mountain landslides, drowned in swamps and rivers. Others were shot or tortured to death.
There was no need to clothe, there was no need to feed, there was no need to protect the lives of these men and women and children. Your life didn't have that sort of economic value, long-term economic value that plantation owners assigned to slaves.
At a time when over 100 men a year were lynched, thousands more were dying in convict lease camps. Death rates in some camps were as high as 45%.
Country, I'm sure, our women cooked all your food and washed all your clothes. We picked all your cotton and laid railroad steel, worked our hands to the bone at your lumber mill. I say, when will we be paid for the work we've done? When will we be paid? Every land to keep this country free, y'all, for women, children, and men. But any time we ask for pay alone, that's when everything seems to turn out wrong. We've been beat up, called names, shot down and stoned. And every time we do right, someone say we're wrong.
When will we be paid?
Stumble through this life for more than 300 years. We've been separated from the language we knew, stripped of our culture. People, you know it's true. Tell me now,
when will we be paid for the work we've done? When will we be paid?
Sweet.
Mavis Staples asking, when will we be paid for the work we've done? Oh, yes, this is about teaching critical race theory. I can't help but say, as you're listening to Jim Crow, then and now, a Equal Rights and Justice special, and I'm Mimi Rosenberg, that anti-critical race theory laws are on my mind in response to this, like the one we mentioned earlier that was passed in Tennessee, as well as Texas, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Florida. And they're not just aimed to push back against the heightened awareness of the nation's history of racial injustice in the wake of the popularity of the 1619 Project and last summer's massive protests over the murder of George Floyd. They are attacks on educators and on expertise itself. Conservatives' current obsession with critical race theory is disguising one's discomfort with racial reconsideration as an intellectual critique.